Welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange Ask the Expert session. Today's topic is Key Functions of the WebSphere Data Power SOA Appliances. My name is Joseph Lam, and this session will give you the opportunity to speak to our panel of experts on a variety of subjects related to today's topic. Moving on to slide number 2. In today's session, we'll start off by introducing to you our panel of experts. We will then move on to give you a brief introduction to key functions of the WebSphere Data Power SOA appliances. Next, our panel of experts will answer questions that were pre-submitted to us through email. Then, we will open the lines for a live Q&A period. And finally, the session will end with a summary of today's webcast. Moving on to slide number 3. At this time, I would like to introduce you to our panel of experts for today's call. Our panel consists of Dominic Michelli, Data Power Level 2 Support Engineer.
Hi, everyone. I'm Dominic. I've been a member of the L2 Data Power Support team for the past 3 years. My primary focus on the team was to lead up the web service proxy group, as well as work on related issues like memory problems and network cases.
Thank you, Dominic. Unfortunately, Alfred is not here today, so we'll move on to Doreen. Doreen Yelton, Data Power Level 2 Support Engineer.
Hi, this is Doreen. I work in data power support on Dominic's team, and I primarily work on integration with Tivoli products like ITCAM SOA, and also work on high utilization or restart issues.
Thank you, Doreen. Next, we have Chin Sahu, Data Power Level 2 Support Engineer.
Hi. My name is Chin Sahu, and I work with Doreen and Dominic in the same team. My specialty is to, work in the integration issues with the data power and MQ and message broker, as well as JMS and WSRR and UDDI.
Thank you, Chin. Then with Moses Alate Pepol, Data Power Level 2 Support Engineer.
Hi, everyone. This is Moses, and I've been with the team for about 4 years now. My area of expertise are FTP, SFTP, FTPS, integration, dealing with SQL, MQ, typical, and the web service proxy, and also the web application firewall.
Thank you, Moses. And finally, we have Paul McGanney, Data Power Level 2 Support Engineer.
Good morning, everyone. This is Paul McGanney. I work with Moses and Chin and Doreen and Dominic on the same team. I've been with Data Power Level 2 support for over 3 years. My area of specialty is FTP, SFTP, FTPS, ODDC, and integration, and helping out on other problems the best I can when they do occur.
Thank you, Paul. So before we get to the question and answer period, our panel would like to give you a technical overview of the topic. Moving on to slide number 4, and please go ahead, Paul.
Yes, again, good morning, everyone. We're going to take you through 6 sample questions and then 5 questions that have been asked by you, the customer, during this Ask the Expert session. So for just a brief introduction, the Data Power Appliance touches many technologies, and what I have listed here on this slide are just a few. As you can see, MQ is involved, ODDC, FTP, HTTP, HTTP, just to name a few. Joseph, can we please move to slide number 5? On this slide, we just want to point out that with the comprehensive breadth that the data power device supports, they are indeed very highly configurable, but by the same token, we have areas that could potentially lead to further diagnosis and troubleshooting. Joseph, if you would, can we move to the first question, slide number 6? Okay, The first question is as follows. What are the configurable components needed for an SFT implementation, and what is the differentiation between SFTP and FTPS? Well, first of all, Joseph, you might want to move to slide 7. Well, first of all, the differentiation is that FTPS is over SSL and SFTP is over SSH. For FTPS, Data Power implements FTP over explicit TLS SSL. On this slide, we're pointing out since the release of the 3.8.1 firmware, from an SFTP perspective, Data Power supports, and I have listed the SSH client profile, an SFTP polar frontside handler, SFTP client policy, SFTP backends, and this new tool, a convert crypto key object, which allows you to get public data from an RSA key. Joseph, if we can please move to slide number 8. Okay, let's talk about a typical Data Power configuration in which we use a multi-protocol gateway and have as its front end an SFTP polar frontside handler and SFTP backend. First, there is some setup that has to be performed. First, we need to look at the SSH client profile. The SSH client profile will have to be associated to the SFTP polar frontside handler in which you are retrieving files from. Files from being the SFTP server. And there would have to be an SSH client profile that is associated to the back-end SFTP server destination. For the back-end server, we would have to set up additionally an SFTP client policy in the user agent of the XML manager. The SFTP client policy would have a match expression which matches the back-end destination. For example, SFTP colon forward slash 10.100 .110.110 asterisk. It is in the SFTP client policy that we reference the SSH client profile, which is then associated to the backend SFTP server. In addition, I want to point out that when you configure an SSH client profile, you have two different types of authentication methods. You can use go by username, which is pretty straightforward, or you can use a key. If you're going to use a key, you're going to have to extract the public key data from the RSA key and put that data into a file called authorized_keys on the SFTP server. If the authorized_keys file does not exist, you'll have to create it. Now, this authorized_keys file must go into the directory called .ssh, and the .ssh directory will be under the home directory of the username that is associated to the SSH client profile on Data Power. I know that's a lot of words, but during the Q&A, we can talk about that in a little more depth. Joseph, if we could please move to slide number 9. Okay, I think we touched upon this, the SFTP polar, you know, frontside handler needs to be associated to an SSH client profile as well as an SFTP backend. We did touch upon the SFTP client policy. Joseph, if you would, can we please move to slide number 10? Yep, this is the authorized_keys file that we would have to put on the SFTP server if we're using an authentication of key. And then the SSH, the authorized_keys file, I just put in there a little blurb of an entry in that file would look like. Let's move on to the next slide, Joseph. I just wanted to point out here that there are two methods for extracting public key data from the RSA key. We can use open SSH tools, or we can use this new tool in Data Power since 3.8.1 called convert crypto key object. That'll get us the public data. Okay, Joseph, please move to slide number 12. Okay, at this point, I'd like to hand the presentation over to my colleague, Doreen Yelton, who will take you through question number 2.
Thank you, Paul. Question number 2 is, can Data Power Multiprotocol Gateway service be monitored by ITCAM for SOA? Joseph, can you go to slide 13? ITCAM for SOA is one of the Tivoli products I mentioned during the introduction, and you can monitor multiprotocol gateways with ITCAM SOA, which will help you understand what your response time is like and how many messages are being processed by the gateway, and how large the messages are, And there are actually sample style sheets that you can use that are published on the Internet at the URLs on this slide to put in the processing policy for your multi-protocol gateway so that statistic and metric information will be passed from Data Power to ICCAM SOA. The Info Center, for which there's also a link on this page, shows this diagram that's on the slide for your request and response processing logic and kind of what you're doing in each of these steps shown in the yellow and green boxes. What's shown here on this slide is how to map the sample style sheets to the documentation on the Info Center. So you can upload the sample style sheets to your appliance and then just drop them into your processing policy in the exact order shown here on the slide, and you'll be able to monitor your multi-protocol gateway with ICCAM SOA. Can you go to slide 14, please? Once you have the sample style sheets in place, there is one that you'll want to customize for your own business. The reason that you have to do some style sheet programming for multi-protocol gateways is because they don't have a WSDL that defines the ports and operations that are valid for the service like a web service proxy has. So for a multi-protocol gateway, you specify an appropriate port name and operation name, and those will be passed over to ICCAM SOA and actually show up in the Tivoli Enterprise portal when you're looking at metrics for your service. So the sample style sheets have IBM.com kind of dummy values for port and operation, and you need to go into the style sheet and change those values to something appropriate for your multi-protocol gateway. Another tip is to always remember to take the style sheets that we show to add to the response rule and add them to an error rule so that you collect metrics for errors that are processed by your multi-protocol gateway. Slide 15, please, Sissus. So I'll turn over the presentation now for question number 3.
Hi, everyone. This is Dominic. I'll be taking question 3 here. This is pretty much going to be a brief overview of how you can use Data Power's extension functionality. It's pretty much in addition to the XSL that's available in Data Power, so we can do encrypt and decrypt. Joseph, if you can move to slide 16, please. So there are a few decisions you have to make when you decide to use encryption on Data Power. First, it's important to note that Data Power does not support the electronic code book. This is because it's not considered a really hardened encryption. You use CipherBlock instead. And what you do have is you have the option of using triple DES or AES in its different block sizes. Afterwards, once you decide what encryption you're going to use for your data, you have to decide how you're going to transport your key. You can use the standard RSA 1.5. We also support OAEP, which is encryptional padding. So if you want to do that, you can do that for your key. But you have to keep in mind that the key transport has to be the RSA-OAEP, which you can see there. Joseph, slide 17, please. So what I did here is I just set up 3 steps pretty much for encrypting and decrypting here. Each of these steps has to be included in an XSL variable, so they get assigned and you can pass them on. What we have is first the recipient I want to note, because the way that this works is you're taking your certificate and you're either passing in the name in Data Power. Pretty much when you create your crypto object, you set a name to that certificate. You can specify that here, or you can specify a base64 value of that certificate. So to begin encrypting, first you have to generate the key, and that's using the algorithm which I had shown you on the first page. After you have that generated key, you use that variable output, and you put it into the encrypt key here. And that's, you know, applying the optional encrypting padding as well as, you know, the key transport you want to use. After that, then you can finally encrypt the data, and you're passing in the encryption type, obviously the algorithm, and you're passing in the session key you just created. And finally, the node attribute is pretty much allowing you to specify where in your XML document you want to encrypt. decrypting is similar. Pretty much you have your key that was encrypted already, and now you need to decrypt it. And, you know, the optional encrypting padding is also shown as the null variables at the end there. Afterwards, you then can decrypt with the same algorithm you used before and that decrypted session key, and you pass in the data, which is Base64 encoded. Afterwards, you probably want to use the DP parse so you can get the actual Base64 result instead of the binary output. I added a few links down the bottom here. Pretty much for those who want to just use a transformation, instead of a transformation, you want to use just the encrypt and decrypt action. The developer's guide is at the bottom there. Also, the extension functionality is linked here, which will tell you all the details of how to use this extension functionality I just described. That's it for this presentation. I would like to pass it on to Chin on slide 18.
Oh, hi. This is a question that why the reply message not received by data party in an MQ request reply flow. At this time, we're assuming that you have a multi-protocol gateway which is configured to use the MQ as the back-end service, even the front-side handler. And when you are sending the request with the reply message, expecting that reply message should be received by data power, sometimes the reply message doesn't come. So we'll explain why that happens. So go to the slide number 19, please. Data power consider a message to be response when the request message ID populated to the response message correlation ID. So that's what I mentioned. When request.mqmd.messageid is equal to reply.mqmd.correlation ID, it means that the reply message must contain the request message ID in its correlation ID. And this particular operation is done by the backend application who is preparing the response message. It is not the data power who is creating the message. Therefore, if this condition doesn't satisfy, data power will not consider that message as a response, and therefore will not get the message to data power. And the other part, that when you are creating the DPMQ URL for your backend, you can specify, you know, the syntax that I have mentioned here is called the DPMQ:// the MQ manager object, the queue manager object with request queue and reply queue given in this syntax with a set reply to true equal to true. So that will basically need to be specified so that the reply to queue will be populated in the MQMD, and the backend application which consumes the request message will know where which queue to put that. Go to the slide number 20, please. Now, if you are using the unit of work, which is the transactional feature supported in data power, then you should use a DPMQ URL with the same call, DPMQ:// the MQ queue manager object and the request queue name, reply queue name. Then you will specify the tag transactional equal to true, sync equal to true, and also set reply to equal to true. Now, in this case, I want to point out that the sync equal to true is critical. That means when the request message is put to the request queue, that message will be immediately committed. Therefore, the consuming application, in this case, the backend application, which will take that message and prepare the response, will be able to access that message. If you do not put sync equal to true, the message is not committed. Therefore, other application cannot access the message. But once it is committed, then the transactional feature still is under the sync point. Therefore, the entire transaction from the request to the response will be in the sync point, and therefore the transaction option is still in hold. I mean, it's continuing. Then again, I also pointed out that the set reply to true is the tag which allows you to specify by meaning that, you know, this particular feature will make the reply to queue populated automatically by data power. There is a different method you can also use if you don't specify set reply to queue tag, is that you can also inject the MQMD reply to queue by using the header method or the style sheet. Plus, please do not use both. That way, that if you are trying to use the first method by injecting the header and then using the set reply to tag, then the last action being the URL open call, so it will override the previous header injection. So that's why I think you either use set reply to tag in the URL, or you can just use the header injection method by using a style sheet or header tag to provide the reply to queue. Go to the slide number 21, please.
This is Moses, and I'll be handling question number 5. If you've already started using DataPower, you most likely have a need to use some style sheet to perform, you know, custom processing of some document. And you also like to profile that style sheet. So question 5 goes, I'd like to profile my style sheet on DataPower. Does DataPower provide this functionality? Slide number 22, please. So yes, this is possible to do on DataPower. There's a style sheet profiler, and the profiling actually measures the processing time of the style sheet that you choose to profile. You know, because it's a profiling tool, it's not recommended for use in your production environment. So you may want to do this in maybe your test or your dev environment. Now, for you to be able to get a style sheet profile, you need to set this up through the compile options policy, which can be found through the XML manager attached to the service. So if you, whatever service that you're using, web service proxy, multiple core gateway, XML firewall, or the web application firewall. Now, on the compile options policy, you have to create a profile rule and have a match expression to match on the style sheets that you're interested in profiling. Slide number 23, please. So what are some of the areas that will be measured or can be measured? So you can look at the global variables that are created. So the profiling will check the time spent to define each, you know, global variable. Then the execution of the template, how long that is taken, that is also going to be measured. If you have some, you know, special entities, or if you're interested in defining your own scope or region that you want the style sheet, you want the profiling to measure, you can also do that. Now, for you to be able to do this custom measurement, you can use the DataPower extension element or an extension attribute. The extension element you can use to specify the scope in which you want the profile to be done. So you use the data power, the DP colon profile. DP is just the namespace prefix, but then the namespace for that is actually defined in the, which is http://www.datapower.com/extensions, and the element name is profile. Now, within this element, you can put all your statements that you want to have measured. Now, for the attribute, you actually include this on the statement. So, for instance, if you have a URL open call in your style sheet, you can include this attribute on that statement, on that URL open call, and that can measure the time that it takes for the URL open to complete its processing. Slide number 24, please. So once this has been set up and you've run some requests through the processing rule for the style sheet to get executed, you can take a look at the profiled results. If you're doing this from the CLI, you can switch to the domain that you have the profiling done and execute the show profile CLI command or from the web GUI in the domain of interest, you can look at this through the left navigation, status, and stylesheet profiles. Or you can send a request through the XML management interface. And also, if you need more information about this, an example on the specifying your own region using the DP profile extension element or attribute, you can access the link provided on the slide 24. Slide number 25, please. Now hand over to Paul to handle question number 6.
Question number 6 reads, how can DNS cause problems with data power device configuration and data flow? So DNS can be used by all services and protocols, and two examples could be with an NF server and a log target. Joseph, can we please go to slide number 26? So as I mentioned, it can be used by all services and protocols. A few examples could be with NFS, where if NFS is unable to mount a remote directory, even though the permissions are properly set, the NFS reverse lookup on the NF server may be failing to confirm the host name via reverse lookup on the string presented by the data powered device. Another example is with a logging target. If we're pointing to some host name and it fails to resolve the host name, the logging target can fail to send log events. And under some conditions with load, the device could try to resolve the host name for every log event generated. Joseph, can we please move to slide number 27? So if DNS resolution is required, just one thing to keep in mind, that there's going to be some complexity that is added to the setup. And it could include proper routing and availability of the DNS server, response time of the DNS server, adding latency, DNS cache timeout, and DNS failures or unexpected responses or invalid responses when records are updated. Joseph, can we please move to slide number 28? Okay. Question 7. Questions 7 through 11 are the questions that have been asked by you, the customer. And question number 7 goes as, how long does the data power cache the IP address of remote services like backend server when we use DNS names? The question continues to say, I'm asking this question because it allows the backend team to replace the backend server with a disaster recovery site when the backend server crashes. And then the second part is, I know that data power DNS cache depends upon time to live value in present when it requires DNS server to resolve the IP address. Will this hold good for this? Data power does indeed honor DNS time to live, and we have seen cases in the field where the usage of the DNS time to live is as low as 5 seconds. Now, there could be instances where a resolved address still has an open connection, and this connection is in an established state. Those connections are not going to be effective if the DNS TTL has expired and the device has performed like another lookup for the host name and retrieved a new IP, because then new connections will use that new IP address. Joseph, if we can please move to slide number 29. Okay, that's pretty much. So it does honor TTL, and then when the TTL has expired, you know, those established open connections will still be in use, but for new connections, if another lookup for the DNS hostname was done, that new IP address is going to be used by new connections. Joseph, can we please move to slide number 30? Okay, at this point, this is to continue with questions from our customers. And question number 8, I would like to turn it over to my colleague Moses.
Thanks, Paul. So question number 8 reads, what is the difference between configuring duration monitor filters and SLM monitors? Slide number 31, please. So there are some few differences between the message duration monitor and SLM. For the duration monitor, this is actually a subset of SLM. So it's lightweight and it's very fast because it's doing fewer things comparison-wise. Now, for you to be able to use the duration monitor, you have to attach it to the service or attach it at a service level. For SLM, that can actually perform the functions of the duration monitor as well. So it's heavier, in terms of capabilities, it's heavier than the duration monitor. And for you to implement SLM, you have to use this in a processing policy, using the SLM action and adding the SLM policy to the SLM action. So you define all your SLM rules or policies within the SLM policy object. Slide number 32, please. So I'll handle question number 9 as well. So the question for that is, why doesn't SLM monitor express threshold in milliseconds? Slide number 33, please. So actually, you can express the threshold in milliseconds, but this is only true if you're using any of the latency threshold types, which are internal latency, backend latency, or total latency. Slide number 34, please. And I'll hand this presentation back to Paul.
Thank you, Moses. So question number 10 reads, why does the DP get cert details extension function depend only on objects or a base 64 string? And why can't it read cert files for details, and are there plans to enhance this function? Well, you know, a customer can certainly submit an enhancement request for this, but Data Power is not really designed as a key certificate repository. So functions like DP get cert details were designed to work with configured crypto certificate objects. And Joseph, if we can please move to slide number 35. So the whole essence of DP get cert details is that it accepts a base 64 encoded certificate or the metadata, which is used by the appliance in configuring the crypto certificate object. And by doing this, it allows a developer to access certificate details either received in a request transaction or configured and usable within a service. The other point I'd like to ask is, during the questions and the answer period, I would like to know, you know, what is the use case that's trying to be implemented that requires DP cert details to resolve arbitrary file paths? So, and we can talk about that a little bit later. But, Joseph, if we can please move to slide number 36. And at this point, I would like to hand off question number 11 to my colleague, Jin.
Yeah, the question number 11 also came from the customer. And the question reads like, why does the CPU and memory usage of the device suddenly rise even when there is no significant increase in message flow? For example, traffic flow amongst two devices is equivalent, but one device is peaking at 45% CPU and 50% memory, while the other device is at 2 to 3% CPU and 5 to 10% memory usage. The configuration on both the devices is completely identical. Please move to the slide number 37. I think it all depends, you know, what is the traffic coming to the device. And, you know, the CPU and memory are directly affected by the activity generated by client traffic or even the device-generated traffic such as MQ or FTP polars, or even sometimes the internal cleaning of the connection when there are some errors or error condition happens. So most often, if there is significant difference in CPU or memory or connection, etc., the detailed information about the statistics, about certain connection, the handles, we have a tech note that describes what specific statistics we can check so that you can see. You know, it is possible that the front-side handlers are pulling the back-end queues or service, and sometimes the back-end service is not available, and the data retry parameters are set by the default value, which are very aggressive. So if you do not set it, you know, based on the best practice, so naturally those kind of probably affect these CPU or memory usage. Even if you have the identical configuration, the back end may affect. Sometimes the network may affect. So these are some of the things we can debug or troubleshoot if we collect these information, you know, as outlined in this tech note. is called the collection of data power statistics. Also, there is another factor is the firmware version. Sometimes the earlier firmware are a little bit, you know, slow in the sense that the algorithm was used in a different way, but the newer firmware using different algorithm. So that's why the collection of status providers are more efficient. So those kind of things are also related to the CPU and memory usage. So I think that the net of it that if you see these differences, there are certain internal states like the connection, the handle, the memory, you know, consumption, those things, the data must be collected by using the method that we describe in the tech note, and then we can tell exactly why one device showing higher CPU or higher memory usage compared to the other. Go to the next slide, please. 38, please. Slide number 30. Now I will pass on the presentation to Joseph that he can open the question and answer.
Thank you, Chin, and thank you to our panel of experts for answering the pre-submitted questions. And at this point in time, Jackie, we would like to open the line for a live Q&A period. And while we wait for the first question through the telephone, I am going to switch to the first question that we have in the web conference. And the first question is, what is the key? Is it the public certificate, thumbprint, serial number, or any other parts?
Hi, this is Moses. Can you clarify which part? Is this for SFTP or is this for encryption decryption? If it's for SFTP, then this should be the SSH key, which should be the public key.
Thank you, Moses. And we will take one more question from the group chat before you get to the question to the telephone. The second question through the group chat is, can the panel of experts advise on the use case for multi-protocol gateway?
Hi, this is Doreen. Mohan asked that question during my section. A web service proxy is another service in Data Power, and customers typically use that when they truly have a web service in the back end that's defined by a WSDL, a web service definition language, because a web service proxy lets you just load that WSDL up into the Data Power appliance and then assign rules to the different ports and operations that are defined in the WSDL. Multi-protocol gateway is the other big choice for a service where maybe you don't have a WSDL to base the service on. And in addition, as the name implies, multi-protocol gateway, you're trying to map or provide service integration between two different protocols. So a web service proxy, you might typically get a SOAP request over HTTP or HTTPS, but a multi-protocol gateway can handle probably a dozen different protocols on the front end and back end. So if you're trying to go from MQ on the front end to HTTP on the back, or FTP or NFS on either the front or the back, that's typically where customers go with a multi-protocol gateway rather than a web service proxy.
Thank you, Doreen. And Jackie, we are ready for the first question through the telephone.
Our first question comes from Mohanji. Your line is open.
Hey, yeah, that helps answer some of the question I have. And let's say if we don't have, if we expose a MPG multi-protocol gateway as a service, and if we don't have a WSDL, how does the HTTP clients will consume that multi-protocol gateway service?
A multi-protocol gateway is defined with what we call a front-side handler, right? So you choose the protocol you want for your front-side, and if you have clients that are going to come in with an HTTP request, you define an HTTP or HTTPS front-side handler. And a front-side handler just has the IP address and port you want to listen on. So you know, if your customers are, you know, you can define any front-side port in Data Power, but, you know, you might choose port 80, for example. So as soon as you configure that front-side handler in the multi-protocol gateway on port 80, if your customers are using a client like a browser, they could specify the IP address and port for that multi-protocol gateway in their browser and whatever URI is appropriate, and they'll hit that multi-protocol gateway with a GET request from a browser, or you can do a POST request from another kind of client if you have it.
Okay, thank you.
One thing I wanted to add to that last question, if you decide that you need to use a multi-protocol gateway instead of a web service proxy and you're worried about validation, you can always add a validate action on your policy. I just wanted to add that point.
And also, I just want to add one more point. I think the front-side handler, the GET method is not automatically selected. So if you want to use GET method, you have to select. There are several methods defined in the front-side handler. The post, the put, and the, you know, the GET, etc.
Thank you, Chin. So while we wait for the next question through the telephone, I'm just going to take care of a couple more questions through the group chat. So the next question through the group chat is, can the same XSL style sheet be used for hooking up WS proxy and XML FW to ITCAM for SOA?
Hi, this is Doreen, and that was from Ravi during my question number two. For a web service proxy, you actually don't have to do any style sheet programming to integrate with ITCAM SOA. Because web service proxies are WSL-based, Data Power automatically knows how to communicate the port and operation and service information for the request over to ITCAM SOA. So kind of right out of the box, you just enable one checkbox on the Data Power appliance, and you can start collecting metrics for your web service proxy in ITCAM SOA with no style sheets. XML firewalls are not supported for ITCAM SOA, so if it's really important to you to collect metrics on a service that you have implemented as an XML firewall, you might consider migrating the functionality in the XML firewall to a multi-protocol gateway, because a multi-protocol gateway can do anything an XML firewall can do. And then you can add the style sheets that we talked about to your multi-protocol gateway and monitor with ITCAM.
Thank you, Doreen. And Jackie, we are ready for the next question through the telephone.
Our next question is from Ravi Banavara. Your line is open.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. So my question was about the DP get cert details extension function, and I think the presenter was asking for a use case. So let me delete the use case for argument's sake. So let's say we have a set of certificates loaded on the Data Power device, and we would like to interrogate each certificate using the DP get cert details extension function in order to get some details such as what's the DN, what's the CN, expiration date, CRL, just to name a few. So what's happening is we are depending, or rather we are creating cert objects for every single certificate, and you know, I just wanted to see if we can avoid this redundancy by having the DP cert details function go directly at the certificate file. I've also seen that if we read the certificate file using the get file function, it converts it as a base 64 string. The certificates which are existing in the binary format, the DIR format, they will be easily interpreted by the get cert details, but certificates which are existing already in the base 64 format, such as the PEM files which come out of the box, they are not read successfully by the get cert details extension function, because it's a double base 64 conversion. So how do we get around this problem? Is there a way in which we can have this get cert details extension function read the cert files directly?
Hi, Ravi. This is Paul McGanny. Thank you for your use case. I had to talk to our security team to get some of the material that I talked about in the answer of that question. I'd like to engage them one more time, but I would like to know what is your email address. This way I can have a dialogue with you and get back to you.
Sure, not a problem at all. I can actually convey my email address and contact details to Joseph Lam. Is that a good approach?
That would be great, Ravi. That would be great, and then I can get back to you as soon as possible, and we can have a dialogue, and I can involve our engineering team as needed.
Okay, much appreciated. I do have some questions on the SLM monitors and the duration monitors, but I'll hold off until, there might be another person in line to ask questions.
Out of curiosity, have you tried passing in the get cert details the cert colon instead of name colon, and
yes,
then pass on, so it doesn't work in that circumstance? Is that what you're trying to say?
Yep, that's right.
Okay.
I've tried that. So the condition, so what I'm trying to do is, if I may take one more minute, I'm trying to interrogate the certificates available in the PubCert folder. PubCert folder comes with a bunch of CS certificates by default, and we would like to know beforehand when these certs expire or if the CRL goes, gets updated. So what happens is there are a lot of PEM files available out of the box, and these PEM files are basically base 64 versions of the public CS certificates. So we'd like to know the details of these certificates by using the get cert details function. Unfortunately, what happens is we cannot pass the file name to the get cert details function. Rather, we have to pass a base 64 string. So if I use cert colon, then it expects a base 64 string. So I read the file using the get file extension function using the XML management interface. And then that output is actually a base 64 version of the target file. So what is happening over here is it is converting a base 64 string into another base 64 string. And so the get file, get cert details function fails. So
right,
I've
yeah.
done all kinds of twists and turns, but I'm not able to get over that function, get over that problem. So we had to create redundant cert objects in order to use the get cert extension function.
Okay, that makes sense. So, yeah, so since in that case that it is encoding it again,
yeah.
I would expect that you would be able to base 64 decode it and it would end up as your original result.
I tried that. It failed.
It fails. Okay. Yeah. Then we'll take that offline and we'll talk to development about that.
Very good. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And we have no further questions on the phone.
So the next question is, does Data Power support FTPS or it's only SFTP enabled?
Hi, Joseph. This is Paul McGann. Yes, it supports FTPS and SFTP. With FTPS, you would just have to, you know, create a certificate. We've supported that for quite some time right now. It's the SFTP that was newly brought into the product in the 3.8.1 release. So again, yes, FTPS and SFTP are both supported by Data Power.
Thank you, Paul. And the next question is, can Data Power rotate keys, let's say, for every 90 days?
Hey, this is Dominic again. I actually followed up in the chat, but I think that probably the best option there would probably be to use the XML management interface. It's pretty much like a SOAP interface. You just send requests to it, and you can upload and replace files or create new certificates or keys that way.
Thank you, Dominic. And the next question is the functionality of ITCAM for SOA provided in WAMC?
Hi, this is Doreen. The WAMC is WebSphere Appliance Management Center, and it does a little bit. There's some overlap with ITCAM SOA because they're all Tivoli products. The major function of WAMC is appliance management, like it says in the name. So if you have appliances, you know that you may be using the same configuration on multiple appliances to handle the volume of traffic, business traffic that you have to handle. And if you have a firmware upgrade that you want to do, or if you want to define a new service and deploy it, you have to do that firmware upgrade multiple times. So if you have a dozen appliances, you do a dozen firmware upgrades, and you deploy your new service a dozen times. Dominic mentioned the XML management interface is a way you can do that remotely, you know, without physically logging onto the appliance. But WAMC goes beyond that and lets you define a managed set where one appliance out of the 12 is a master, and you do your deployment of your service one time on that master, and it gets synchronized out to the other appliances in the managed set. Or you can do your firmware upgrade on that master, and then the firmware upgrade also gets synchronized out to the other appliances in the managed set. So that's functionality, appliance management functionality, that's not in ITCAM SOA. ITCAM SOA monitors the traffic going through your appliance. So just like you want to know how many times did my website get hit, you want to know how many requests your data power appliance is processing as well, and how big they are, and how many faults you're getting, and maybe what the size of the messages is. And so ITCAM SOA monitors, it doesn't manage, it monitors the traffic, and WAMC manages the firmware levels and the configuration objects in the appliance. Where there's a little bit of overlap is WAMC also allows you to define where your logs are, and those logs might even be latency logs. Data Power, at the end of every successful transaction, puts out a latency message that says how long the different steps in processing the transaction take, and WAMC can take a look at those latency logs and analyze them and show you where you have high latency transactions. So ITCAM SOA does provide information on response time. WAMC kind of takes a different slant at that and lets you look at latency. So there's a little bit of a similar functionality. And then there's a third component that does SNMP monitoring of appliances. Not the monitoring of the traffic so much as the health of the appliance, the load, the CPU, the memory utilization. And that component for SNMP monitoring is something that kind of is a Tivoli product that's associated with both ITCAM SOA and WAMC. So there's monitoring of traffic in ITCAM SOA, monitoring of kind of the health of the appliance in a data power agent that comes with both ITCAM or WAMC, and then management of the appliance, which is over in WAMC. So kind of the products are, you know, do all different things, but, you know, I can see where getting the functionality straight what is a little confusing. Thanks, Joseph. I hope that answered the question.
Thank you, Doreen. And Jackie, can we open the lines just one more time in case we have any other additional questions?
Robbie Bonavaro, your line is open.
Yes, thank you so much for taking my question. This question is for Moses. This is regarding the SLM monitors as well as the duration monitors and the difference between the two. Thanks for explaining the difference between the two. One of the questions you had asked was about whether you had said that the duration monitors, or rather the SLM monitors, will allow time limits to be set in milliseconds. Unfortunately, it does not allow us to set threshold levels in milliseconds. It allows only in seconds. So I was trying to set up SLM monitor for calculating total latency of a given WS proxy and to notify me with an email whenever it crossed the threshold level of maybe 1.5 or rather 500 milliseconds. Unfortunately, I could not do that with the SLM monitor, so I had to go with the duration monitors and add a threshold filter to it. Unfortunately, what happens is with the threshold filter on a duration monitor, I do not get notified every time the event occurs, that is, the service, if it crosses more than 500 milliseconds, I do not get a notification every time. So I've observed, it's almost like a pattern that I see every alternate occurrence is notified. But so, for example, if the first occurrence of 500 milliseconds crossover is notified, then the second occurrence is neglected. The third occurrence is notified while the fourth occurrence is neglected. So this is kind of a pattern I see. So why is that behavior exhibited, and why does the duration monitor not respect all the event occurrences?
Thanks, Ravi. So for the duration monitor, if you're seeing unexpected behaviors, I think the way forward will be to contact data power support by opening a service request. Then we can take a closer look at that. On the SLM part, I do understand that when you look at the web GUI, it shows the time measurement in seconds. But based on my understanding, when you deal with the latency threshold types, you have to specify the actual latency value, which is in milliseconds. So in this case, if you're dealing with a latency of 500, 500 will have to be the value that you specify.
Oh, I see. Okay. So the documentation actually says that latency is in seconds, but actually it is calculated in milliseconds.
That is correct.
Oh, I see. Okay. To further add to that question, I did configure an SLM monitor on one of our WS proxies. I also increased the latency to say if it crosses 1 second, notify me by email. When I looked at the debug logs, it said that it passed the SLM monitor, but I did not get any notification. But when I calculated the total latency of the proxy, it was more than 1 second. So I think there is either there is an abnormal behavior exhibited by the threshold calculations or the way in which I'm configuring it. So like the other use case, what I can do is I can set up an offline call or probably open a request ticket, and then we can follow up and follow through on this behavior.
Sounds good. Thanks, Ravi.
Thank you so much.
No problem.
And we have no further questions.
Thanks again, Jackie. We will take the final two questions through the group chat. And the first question is there possibility to do some state management for transactions in data power? State management being saving state for correlations between multiple different transactions coming to the box.
That transaction ID can be saved in request response, and if there is an error, then in the error situation. So that transaction ID is unique for each request response or error, the three kinds of data or message that come through. So, but other than that, I don't know what other state they're looking.
Thank you, Chin. All right, so thank you, everyone, and thank you to our panel of experts for participating in the live Q&A period. At this point in time, I would like to move on to slide 40 and pass the presentation over to Paul for a summary of today's session.
Thank you very much, Joseph. So, folks, in summary, we've talked about a variety of topics such as ITCAM for SOA, FTPS, SFTP, SLM, MQ, encryption, and decryption. And it is the hope that the sincere hope that this session has been beneficial to everyone and has armed you all with more information in your continued use of the Data Power SOA appliances. And really appreciate, like I speak for my whole team, really appreciate you all taking time out of your busy day and giving us some of your time and listening to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul, for a great summary. At this point in time, we will conclude the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange session.